CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talk's Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool in Business, and every Sunday we look at some of the week's big business stories affecting Liverpool and the wider Northwest region. Today I'm talking GDP, the changing face of law, elected mayors, UNESCO and much more besides with my studio guests Michelle Helsby from Evolve and the managing partner of Kerwin Solicitors, Simon Gibson. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Morning, Frank.
Simon, you've been on the programme a number of times and we've talked about this thing that has been sort of nicknamed Tesco Law. And this week I noticed that one of our local Liverpool firms, Silverberg Rymer, have been sold. Now, you can talk all you like about what the figures actually mean, but it's a multi-million pound deal, we know that for sure. And as I understand it, it's been sold as part of these legislative changes that have gone through. Is that right?
Yeah, well, definitely. It's a reaction, I think, to the fact that non-legal entities can now own law firms and own stakes in law firms and open law firms. And it was interesting to me because there's so much doom and gloom about amongst lawyers who will have you believe that we're heading for the breadline. But it's clear that business is interested in the legal profession, which it goes without saying means that there's going to be changes in terms of the way law is delivered. But that there's going to be huge opportunity as well for those who are prepared to spot it. So I was really interested to hear the news.
Yeah, and if somebody, whoever's out there, are prepared to go in and invest up to £19 million in any business, it does demonstrate that there must be a value in the industry sector that they're involved in. So even though there are radical changes taking place, and not just in this aspect of legal work, because there are other changes that are currently being discussed in the Commons and the Lords, as we were discussing off air. The potential and the opportunities, as you say, Simon, around the law, still obviously profitable.
Yeah, definitely. But I think what's most interesting to the likes of Quindells, who we're told have bought Silverbecks, is that they can actually improve that value, because law firms, I think, still are quite inefficient as a whole. They don't market themselves very well. Quite often they don't have their teams as productive as they can be. Quite often they're not focused on the bottom line the way they could be. So what non-legal entities, what other businesses are seeing is an opportunity to bring in their experiences and skills and apply them in a legal environment. Law's not going away. People are still going to need lawyers. But if we can bring other businesses into the profession who can show lawyers how to be efficient and how to market themselves properly and how to make more profit, then that value's going to increase. And I think ultimately the value to the client will increase. Mm. And that's what these changes are all about, to be fair. So I think for me, it's the first indication that things are really on the move.
Mm. So it almost sounds to me as though it's making legal companies, solicitors, firms more commercial, maybe having to get smarter around the marketing, and maybe a bit more diverse in terms of their offer as well.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I think really what's going to be the next 5 years is going to be all about is that you, as a law firm, you scale up, you scale down, you get bought out, or you get out. Mm. I don't think there's room for many firms to just maintain a status quo. I don't think that in 5 years' time there are going to be many traditional law firms left, because occasionally I speak to a very traditional law firm and they'll tell me that the clients just want to come and see them. But they're not going to. The next generation is going to go on the internet,
yeah,
or they're going to want to deal very conveniently and at really driven value. I think law firms have got to become more commercial. Maybe they do have to become more diverse, but I think they've got to become more focused on delivering the right level of profit.
Mm. Do you think the days of high street law firms have gone then, or do you think there's still going to be a market for that?
Yeah, there will be in the short term. I think there'll be less of them. But I think, you know, there are some high street firms, in inverted commas, who are very well managed, who make good profits, who have a very good reputation, and they're not going to fold overnight. But I think in the longer term, my question for those firms is, who do you want your clients to be? Mm. Now, if they want their clients to be the sort of people who shop on the high street, well, unfortunately, that those numbers of people are dwindling. Yeah. Because, I mean, what is the high street? Yeah. I don't know what a high street is anymore. I don't really go and buy on a high street. I don't think most people do. I go on the internet or I buy in a way which is much more convenient. And I think law firms have got to be aimed at providing the services in that convenient way, quickly and at good value.
Mm. Michelle, good morning.
Morning. Okay. I always switch off when you talk law.
Well, I got out. I was just going to say, you were, of course, a legal practitioner.
I was.
And the sorts of changes that are taking place at this moment in time, had you been around and those changes were being introduced back then, it seems to me that we're moving towards a situation where solicitors' firms are going to be less traditional in their approach. And that perhaps it's going to be a more dynamic, exciting market. Maybe that could have maintained your interest.
Probably would have done, actually, to be honest. These rumblings, I mean, I got out 2005, I think it was, so it's quite a while ago now. But the rumblings of this happening, of what's happening today, was around then. And I remember them saying, oh, the people just have to go to their local supermarket to find themselves a lawyer, you know, and it's taking it to the extreme. However, people, you know, the lawyers were twitchy then. But they've clung on desperately to the traditional way of doing things. A lot of them have. However, the company that I was working in, we're trying to look forward and we're trying to respond to the market, but it was really the market telling them what they required. Traditionally, you know, way back, lawyers would just lift up the file and see how heavy it weighed and put in the bill, you know what I mean? Whereas now they're a lot more accountable, and quite rightly so. But it did make a lot of the old school lawyers very twitchy, because suddenly they were accountable and they had to account for the work that they'd done and how much they were charging.
Is there still resistance to change, Simon?
Yeah, there is, and it's inevitable, because it's law is a very traditional industry, and from the minute people go into university, they have a perception of how their career is going to run. So a lot of lawyers are hopeless at IT. The likes of the co-op who are moving into the market are going to have the most cutting-edge IT systems. They've got a fantastic brand. They've got big resources. But it doesn't mean that you can't, at a level, compete with them. If you've got the right strategy, if you're investing in the right areas, if you have got an understanding of what your clients want, that's what we ask our clients, what do you want? Now, there's no point us trying to tell them that they should want to come into our office to sign a document or to provide instructions when they want to push a button at 11 o'clock at night and provide their instructions electronically and pay by credit card and pay half of what we want them to pay. The question is, how do we adapt our business to what the client wants?
Yeah.
And it's law now is a lot less about the lawyer, a lot more about the client. I think that's positive.
Yeah, and I suppose the people who are coming into the profession now will have that mindset, won't they? They'll have that sort of, if you like, that more modern outlook on how the law should be delivered. But wherever you introduce change, doesn't matter what area, what sector, there's always some resistance, isn't there? And, you know, my feeling of the law firms that we deal with, and perhaps we're just a bit fortunate at downtown Liverpool, but most of them do appear to be the type of companies that actually welcome change as a positive, and, you know, they'll go around the business in a way that will deliver those changes and make a positive impact on the businesses. And I guess the solicitors firms that try and bury their heads in the sand will be those that go by the wayside.
Totally, yeah. And I mean, there's still a lot of that out there. But it, to me, it's not rocket science. It's about, you know, people say the world's changing. Well, the world's changed. It's just that the law hasn't. And it's always the antiquated professions which are the last to change to anything.
Yeah.
But no, to be fair, I know a lot of lawyers who are really welcoming it and who are scaling up. in a way that's going to mean that I don't see an issue with continuing to return good profits and keep your clients happy. That's what it's all about.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what's not returning a good profit at the moment, UK PLC. Because our gross domestic product, we are told, was not as did not perform as well as it ought to have the last quarter, and the IMF have this week announced that they've downscaled what they thought was going to be a 1.6% growth in the UK economy this year to 0.6%. That means that the chances of a recession hitting the UK again is obviously more likely. And depending upon your political persuasion, some people are blaming the existing government, some people are blaming the last government. I seem to think that it's neither this government or the last government's fault. It's actually the world market and the way in which things have sadly occurred in the world of finance. But again, we've sort of talked about this, touched on this in the past. We have all these economists lining up and we have endless discussions on TV and on the radio and in the newspapers, of course, about, you know, whether or not we're going to have a 0.6% growth or 1.6% growth. And Simon, as a managing partner of a law firm, do you wake up of a morning wondering and worrying about what the markets are saying about the stock market prices, about whether we've had growth in the last quarter as a country? Yeah, does it really matter to a business on a day-to-day basis?
I definitely don't wake up worrying about it. I think for me, in terms of being a business owner of any type, it's about reacting and planning properly. I think you're foolish if you don't bear in mind, in terms of how prudent your business planning is, the fact that the economic outlook is not that good. But, I mean, we made certain decisions when we first got a sniff of an economic downturn that have proved to be really, you know, positive, prudent decisions, because we reduced our exposure to areas that were going to be hit by the recession, and we very much increased our exposure to areas which weren't. So we're really proud of that. But I think you've got to stay positive, haven't you? That's one of the most important things.
Well, I just wonder whether, you know, and again, we've talked about this in the past, there's almost too much discussion and debate about the things these days. You know, it's like 24/7.
We were talked into a recession, to an extent, by the media. Yeah. Not saying that it wouldn't have happened anyway, but I think it did happen a lot sooner than perhaps it should have done.
Yeah. And Robert Peston's almost gleeful, isn't he, when he's delivering the bad news?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I do switch off his statistics.
Forlorn, shouldn't he, when he tells us that all these awful things are going to happen and we're going to hell in a handcuffs? But, you know, if you look at the state of the world economy, and we're all touched now by and affected by what's happening in the rest of the world, the euro seems to me to be the place where, you know, there doesn't appear to be any sort of reconciliation or any plan for that currency to get out of the mess that it's in. Now, ironically, you know, the UK isn't in the euro, and yet we are still told we will get clobbered if the euro collapses. Again, you know, from the big picture perspective, do you think that actually governments and the UK government perhaps needs to come clean and say, well, it almost doesn't matter what we do, because unless they sort the mess out over in the Channel, and the Germans, the French and so on get their act together, we're going to be really struggling. Do you think we expect too much of our government now in terms of economic policy and strategy?
Well, I think we've become to expect too much, because, I mean, I hate to say it, I was a Gordon Brown fan, and he, from what my recollection is, he was at the forefront of anything in terms of the global economy, and, you know, other country leaders did look to him for advice, and I think I always felt it, I don't know why, I felt in safe hands when he was there, although that's come back to haunt me a little bit. But now I think we still need to be at the forefront of things, because we always historically have been. And I do think, whilst we are not in the euro, it definitely impacts because of the nature of the exports that we have. I mean, I don't know the statistics, but it's pretty high. I think we do need to be at the forefront, even though we're not in the euro. And we're on the edge, but I do think the fact that we're not in it, it probably does limit our influence. But I do think we need to be there at the table for the benefit of our Certainly our exporting businesses.
OK. Well, bring back Gordon Brown, says Michelle Healthy, as we go towards a break. I never thought I'd hear anyone say that. I jest. I know you didn't say that, really. Stay with us. We'll be back talking elected mayors right after this break.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
And welcome back to the show. I'm joined in the studio this week by Michelle Helsby from Evolve and the managing partner of Kerwin Solicitors, Simon Gibson. Earlier this week, the downtown members were involved in a private meeting with the leader of Liverpool City Council, Joe Anderson, and its chief executive, Jeb Fitzgerald, who outlined plans for the city to adopt a city mayor, elected mayor, cabinet model, which would mean, basically, in simple terms, that we would have a Boris for Liverpool. Hopefully not Boris, but a Boris-type character, the sort of guy or woman who could drive policy, take responsibility for things like economic development and regeneration, and very much be seen as the buck stopping with them. People who would argue against that particular model suggest that Ken Dodd or some other celebrity candidate may end up getting the job. But the big bonus with the model that is being suggested at this moment in time is that you don't just get the badge of elected mayor, but you get a significant amount of resources to go with it. £75 million, I think, was the figure quoted in year one alone, and up to £500 million as the project and position develops. Michelle, you were in the discussion on Thursday morning with Joe and Jed. Were you impressed with what they had to say? Is it something that you think the business world should be getting behind?
Yes, I was there on Thursday and, fascinating because there's been rumblings of an elected mayor for quite a number of years now. And suddenly there is an announcement that we will be voting for one potentially in May. I think we have to go for it, and I think the business sector is welcoming the opportunity with open arms because of the potential for the cash injection and, more importantly, the additional powers that it will give to whoever is the elected mayor in terms of taking the unique issues of the city and looking at those and becoming, you know, addressing them. I don't know what your thoughts are, Frank, on that, but I think that the key to it was more power and cash injection of money.
Well, downtown Liverpool's always advocated an elected mayor, but, you know, for a number of reasons, going back to 2004 when we first started to advocate that, it was because we didn't at that time have a full-time leader. You know, we had someone who was a teacher, then we had someone who was a fireman who were doing the job part-time. So at the very least, we thought an elected mayor, you'd have to be full-time. Joe Anderson then took control of the council, the Labour Party at least did. Joe became leader and took the position as a full-time position. So part of the argument went. But I think what the government are offering here, Simon, is a huge carrot. They're almost, I mean, cynics would say, giving us the money that they've taken off us in terms of the cuts that have been implemented over the last couple of years. But nonetheless, any city, surely, at this moment in time, as Michelle said, the current economic climate, is offered £75 million. We'd be mad to turn it down, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I mean, the investment is a complete no-brainer, isn't it? What's particularly interesting to me, though, is that at last we're going to have a real clarity in who's accountable and responsible for the objectives of the city. So, to me, there's no downside. The argument that you might get Ken Dodd is, come on, it's nonsense. And I mean, like you, I think thought said very persuasively when we were chatting about this off air, you can't oppose any sort of progressive democracy on the basis that you might not like the leader. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think we'll end up with a strong leader for the city who's got the right mandate, who's got the right ability to invest, and above all, who is responsible and accountable for us achieving our objectives. So I just 100% in favour of it.
I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head there in terms of one of the big positives for me is that accountability, because the number of times decisions have been made in Liverpool, and when you ask the question, well, who was responsible for that, there's almost like a pass the parcel game takes place. So you end up with it being from the City Council to the Mersey Partnership to, well, central government. You know, at least here, if we have an individual that sets out an agenda and a strategy, credit where it's due, because we'll know who's delivering the positives. But equally, when things do go wrong, you know, they've got to be big enough and ugly enough to stand up, admit it and move on. But that accountability, I think, is a crucial part of what we're being offered here. I think the other thing that, you know, both Jed and Joe alluded to on Thursday morning is that, you know, for probably 25, 30 years now, Liverpool hasn't done badly as far as public sector resources concerned. And yet here we find ourselves in 2012, still with some of the highest rates of unemployment, with some of the most poverty-stricken wards and constituencies in the whole of the UK. And so somehow, somewhere, that money has not necessarily been directed and spent in the way it ought to have. And I guess that one of the things that we were talking about that were great to see happen in a practical basis is to start to match what the business of the city needs with the skills that we're producing in our schools and through our educational institutions. And I think the great point that you were able to make, Michelle, was that you have been involved in a project where you've brought those agencies together that are responsible for getting unemployed people back into work. And actually, the disconnectivity is quite frightening. You know, I think you named 5 or 6 agencies that you pulled together. Yeah. Now, it's nonsense, isn't it, really?
That's, you know,
and if you've got one person who's responsible for, yeah, okay, you might have to get a lot of people in the room, or she might have to get a lot of people in the room, but at least they can coordinate that.
I think the agencies all know each other, and they do have an element of working together. But the thing that I got is that, like you say, they've never been put in a room and told to address a specific agenda. You know, it's very easy to try and look to solve all of Liverpool's economic problems. But my focus, just to clarify, I was working on the bid for the Royal Liverpool, the development of the Royal Liverpool Hospital. My role was to try and see how that we could make that investment stick in terms of construction jobs and training and apprenticeships. But not just to tick a box and say, yes, we will employ locally. It's really how we target that and how we make it real. And my first job was to think, well, who's doing this already? And there were pockets of agencies that are looking to tackle these issues. But really, historically, on construction jobs in the city, those jobs have gone elsewhere and we haven't truly maximised the benefit from recent projects. So what I did was I went round and I spoke to Liverpool Community College, spoke to Liverpool in Work, Liverpool City Council, Liverpool Mutual Homes, who have a fantastic training programme that they use for, you know, in terms of the social landlords, and they target those deprived areas. So it is happening, but it's happening in pockets. So what I thought was to bring those people together, and we did call it the Local Economic Impact Steering Group, which is a bit of a...
Trips off the tongue.
It doesn't trip off the tongue, yeah. But it will come, you know, no doubt it can hopefully will be renamed in the event that we're successful. But my aim wasn't just to look to be successful on the Royal Liverpool Hospital bid. My aim was to try and put a foundation in place that could be applied to all future, not just construction jobs in the city, but other jobs that, you know, there could be a one-stop shop for people to go to. But with a specific agenda and with targets and with accountability. Mm. And that's what I've tried to do.
And I think a bit more pressure on our educational institutions as well to develop,
yes, the skills that are needed,
who are fit for work.
Yeah.
You know, because, as I say, we've had massive amounts of cash flood into the city. And in the areas of education and training, I have to say, not just in Liverpool, right across the country, billions of pounds have been spent, and yet we still talk about a skills gap. And it doesn't matter whether you're sat in Liverpool, whether you're in Lancashire, whether you're in Manchester, you get the same complaint time after time from employers who say, we simply can't find the right level of staff. And from a professional services perspective, Simon, do you think there's enough interface, enough consultation and dialogue between the likes of yourselves and the people responsible for education?
No, I don't. I don't think it's ever been properly joined up. I think, again, this is back to this issue of having a plan and accountability, in that what we need is for all the major stakeholders to be on the same page. And we need to understand where as a city we're going, what our priorities are. And then we need all of the plans of the individual stakeholders to be consistent with the objectives. So I don't feel that the professional services and educational institutes, for example, I don't really see a connection there. Mm. And in fact, so much has seemed to just happen without it being part of any...
It's absolutely vital that you get the private sector talking to these agencies. Yeah. But to be fair, everybody's at fault, really, because everybody's just so busy trying to get on with their own... with their own agenda. And it's really taking that step back and looking at the bigger picture and saying, how can we, you know, how can we identify the skills that the private sector needs with, you know, tackling the training issues that the public sector can help us with?
And we had Elaine Bowker from Liverpool Community College in last week, the principal, and she was saying, almost go back to the conversation we were having about legal firms earlier, they've almost been in a bubble. Educational institutions, well funded, no real pressure in terms of targets. Okay, the, you know, you can have these phrases thrown at you, whether you be poor, average. Liverpool Community College, very fortunate to get the tag outstanding, not once but twice during the last few years. But she was saying that, you know, very much there is a need from their organisation's point of view to get out there and start to market what they do, because as somebody who would suggest that they know quite a bit about what's going on in Liverpool, I wasn't aware of the range of things that that college actually delivers. So if I don't know, the chances are 95% of the businesses out there who they could be working with and servicing much more effectively don't know. And I think, as with the law, educational institutions now are going to have to wake up and start to become a little bit more responsive to what local businesses and the local community actually needs, rather than just delivering the same old, you know, national curriculum and the tired old stuff, you know, millions of hairdressers, loads of IT operators, all that sort of thing. I think they've got to get far smarter and be more selective in terms of the courses that they teach and their engagement with the private sector as well. But just going back to this elected mayor position, because, of course, it's not just about job creation. I think it's about selling the city and having an individual, a personality that can actually go out there and bang the drum for Liverpool. Because again, if you were to say at the moment, who's responsible for that? Different people will give you different names, not just in terms of the personalities involved, but equally in terms of the organisations responsible. I think where some of the criticism will come is that Liverpool in the Merseyside region will stand alone as having an elected mayor with these sorts of powers and responsibilities, and you will get people from Knowsley, Sefton, the Wirral and so on saying, well, why are Liverpool getting all of that? Any sympathy for them, Simon? Any sympathy for somebody who's sat in Bootle and are not able to see their council getting the same sort of dosh as Liverpool are hopefully going to get if this proposal goes through?
Well, If it's to be applied as sort of as clinically as that, then I suppose the answer's yes. I think on the ambassadorial point, that we want someone actually being the figurehead for the city and going out selling us and talking the talk and sort of banging the Liverpool drum. I mean, it's got to be for the region, hasn't it? It's got to be an ambassador for the region. It's not about sectioning up the various councils and districts. We need a figurehead for the region.
Well, I think the ideal model would have been a city region mayor. Yeah. And I think Liverpool tried to negotiate that with the local authority partners and couldn't get it through. But again, I think if you get the right person, you're absolutely correct there, Simon. They will actually go out and talk about Liverpool as a city region. The fact is that if Liverpool as a city performs well, then the likes of Sefton, Knowsley and the Wirral will benefit anyway, because the people who take the jobs that are created here are going to come from all parts of Merseyside. It's not just going to be from the city of Liverpool. So, you know, from my personal point of view, I think it's a really positive move. We'll certainly be getting behind it. We've asked our membership this week in a poll that we're doing as to whether they support it. But in the past, when we've run that poll, over 80% have said they think an elected mayor would be a good thing for Liverpool. And, well, there'll be much more discussion on this between now and May. We've discussed as well in the programme recently UNESCO and World Heritage status. Unfortunately, they were back in town this week and we'll be discussing it again. Stay with us. We'll be back after these ads.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Well, welcome back to the programme. Well, we've been talking about elected mayors for Liverpool, and if I was advising the elected mayor, whoever he or she may be, the first thing I would tell them to do is to hand back this certificate on the wall that is called World Heritage Status, because as far as I'm concerned, it's an absolute waste of space. I don't think it delivers one extra visitor to the city, and all it does is put barriers in the way of potential redevelopment and regeneration. Liverpool Waters, which we've been talking about now for 99 years, is still in its planning stages. The people at UNESCO have had about a million committee meetings. They're still saying it needs to be scaled back for them to be satisfied. I think Peel have now amended the plans half a dozen times. They've invested millions of pounds in trying to get the plans through. Those plans will create an absolutely fantastic set of buildings. They create jobs, they create investment. And yet here we are today, having had another report back from UNESCO on Wednesday saying that they refuse to support the project and alternatives need to be found. I'm just getting absolutely sick and tired of us having to deal with this heritage lobby. Now, Michelle, you may have an alternative view.
I don't think I'd probably have put it as strongly as that, but I'm not far off. I do agree. It's a nice thing to have. I do think Liverpool is a World Heritage city anyway, without a certificate. You know, you can't deny that. You know, the buildings and the architecture that we have is second to none in terms of comparison to the rest of the world. I do think people do come here to see it, but I don't think that's the only thing they come to Liverpool for. There's an abundance of other reasons why people visit the city. I think Liverpool City Council have to be commended for the fact that they've only ever, you know, tried to engage with UNESCO and English Heritage with a view to looking for a compromise. However, like you said, time is ticking on, and I'm quite grateful for the fact that hopefully by March, you know, I'm assuming and I'm guessing that the planning permission will be granted. I understand that that doesn't mean that the World Heritage status will go right away. My understanding is we are then put, if things don't change, we are put on an at-risk register, which did make me smile. and that, you know, it only ultimately, we lose that once the development starts. And again, how long are we going to be away from that? With more, you know, government bureaucracy and legislation to get through, no doubt.
Well, the biggest problem is that the application could get called in and delay the development by a further 3 or 4 years. And then if you look beyond that, you have to say, how patient are Peel as a developer going to be? You know, because there are other opportunities out there. You know, there are other cities that are crying out for investment. There are no other city that I can see that is as pestered and mithered by these heritage lunatics as we are. And I just, you know, I've said before on air, if there's anybody out there from the heritage lobby who wants to come in and discuss this with me, because I can't for the life of me understand or appreciate why somebody being unable to see the Liver buildings from the Strand in Bootle is an important part of what makes Liverpool a tourist destination. If I was to offer most people in Bootle the opportunity of a job, or a view of the Liver buildings, I don't know which one they'd take. So the whole argument for me is an absolute nonsense. And somebody actually anonymously sent me a message a few days ago saying, well, are you saying that jobs in the construction sector and in the sectors that Peel are going to create is more important than visitor economy jobs? No, of course they're not. What I'm saying is visitor economy jobs will not be affected one iota by a development on the north side of the dock. In fact, I would argue they'll be increased.
Yeah.
Because people who are coming through North Liverpool will see a gateway that actually looks like a modern 21st century and not an absolute flea pit, which is what it looks like now. I'll get off my soapbox for a second, Simon, and let you come. Simon will say, well, I'm from English Heritage. We advise them.
No, listen, I agree with you both. I think if architecture, for example, is the reason why some visitors come to the city, then surely our architecture sells itself. I just cannot believe that having a badge is the deal maker in terms of increasing that influx of visitors. And we all know that bureaucracy and inertia are very much the causes of failure to grow and failure to succeed. And the whole business with British Heritage, it's all just got so horribly disproportionate that even if you acknowledge that there's a role for checks and balances in terms of growth, which there undoubtedly is, to have this such sort of stubborn opposition to what seemed to me to be well thought out, good strategy and plans for the good of the area, I don't see whose interests it's in. I don't see who the winners are.
No. I, you know, it's so frustrating for me because, as I say, I can understand why people would want to say, don't put anything directly in front of the Liver buildings, or, you know, you can't do anything that is going to put those buildings at risk. Yeah. But what I can't for the life of me understand is, you know, if you can't see it from a particular point 3 miles away, then a development has to be stopped. I just can't get my head around the logic. And, you know, if you're talking about what makes Liverpool a strong visitor economy, it's music, it's fashion, it's football, it's our museums, it's our business, it's maritime. You know, there's a whole range of things outside of the list of buildings. And for me, you know, what we ought to be doing is looking to creating an environment and buildings that in 100 years' time people are talking about. You know, where's the next Liver building for our city? You know, that's 100 years old. When are we going to build something that in the next century people are going to be start talking about it as an iconic building? These people would have us build nothing else. Just leave the whole city in Aspie.
Well, yeah, that's my question, when will they ever be satisfied? Because they just keep saying, I keep reading the term scaling back. But, you know, we're a bold and ambitious city and we want to give out the message that, you know, we're forward thinking and we want people to come here. We want people to look at the new developments and go, I want to bring my business here. I want to do business here. I want to live in Liverpool and I want to work, you know, I want to work there. And that's what we need. We need the inward investments and we need to send out that bold message. If we keep scaling back, it goes against the grain of what Liverpool is, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, it just sounds to me as though they want to create, you know, lots of little Lego land.
That's right, yeah.
Because it's all
another
about
Albert
the
Dock. You're not going to get another Albert Dock.
No, I do worry about some of these people because they seem obsessed with size.
Yeah.
And I worry about people who are obsessed with size. And, you know, the other thing I have to say to English Heritage is, look, you know, there's a place that I live like 2 minutes away called Skelmersdale that needs your attention. And there's no high buildings in Skem. And I'm sure we'd all say, all
have
of us who grew up there, we would love to have some skyscrapers. So come and advise us on how we can improve our environment and leave Liverpool to get on and develop. Because you're driving me nuts. Driving me nuts. I don't know how often we're going to discuss this on this programme. I get increasingly wound up every time we discuss it. Because every time you think Peel and the City Council have compromised to the point where nobody could possibly object, they come back and, as you say, Michelle, they never seem satisfied.
No.
Just crackers, absolutely crackers. A guy who would definitely have been as passionate in their support of Peel Waters and the position that I've just articulated there is a man called Paul Rice. Paul was the chief executive of Liverpool's Commercial District Partnership and sadly he passed away last Saturday. He was appointed as chief executive of the BID in 2006, but sadly 18 months ago was diagnosed with MDS, which was a form of cancer similar to leukaemia. Throughout the whole time, he battled with courses of chemotherapy, underwent a bone marrow transplant in the Royal Liverpool Hospital in January last year. And despite very intensive, invasive and gruelling treatment, he continued to work seemingly tirelessly and successfully campaigned to secure a yes vote in the ballot last year to achieve that business improvement district status. Paul was highly regarded in the business community, his passion, commitment and energy appreciated by everybody who had the privilege to work with him. He was a devoted supporter of Liverpool. But because of the sort of character he was, even I didn't hold that against him. And he was very, very much involved in the spirit of Shankly Supporters Union. I think he was either chair or certainly a leading position within that organisation. His funeral takes place this week, 1st of February, at the Wigwam, the Catholic Cathedral. I know there'll be hundreds of people to show their respects and pay tribute to Paul. Michelle, you, like I, knew Paul very well. What a fantastic guy. Everybody's going to miss him.
Yeah, I feel very privileged to have the opportunity to voice that, sitting with you here, Frank, to talk about Paul, because I know there'd have been hundreds and hundreds of people, like you say, they'll all be there at the cathedral on Wednesday, who just adored him, from professionally and personally. I was trying to think about when I first met Paul, and when I first came onto the business scene about 6 or 7 years ago, he was on the list of people to meet that I was advised, and I heard that his title of chief exec of the commercial district partnership, and I had this vision of a obviously very straight-laced, proper chap. And I walked into, I can't say it, the living room one night and heard this almighty voice singing cop songs from the back of, you know, I think it was Christmas or something. And I was like, who is that? And it was Paul. And I remember thinking, okay, that's not the impression that I thought the chief exec of the commercial district partnership would be. But I just instantly smiled, and we obviously didn't do any business that night, but I got to know Paul particularly well at MIPIN the following year. He took me under his wing. I was a bit like a rabbit in the headlights down in Cannes there. And, you couldn't help but be enthused by his passion for the city. And he always had a smile on his face. But the point is, he acted on his passion. You know, we all spout off and we all have our say, but he did look to do something about it. Mm. And in everything that he did, be it, you know, for the city, be for the bid, be for his friends, be for the Spurs of Shankly, and no doubt other things that we're probably not aware of. And as I say, I feel very privileged to have, you know, shared that with him and to have worked with him and got to know him personally. Mm. It's just extremely sad.
Yeah, and the great thing about Paul was that as much as anything, he was an absolutely proud Scouser. Yeah. But he actually delivered this model, this sort of public-private sector partnership, very successfully in Manchester. And obviously we operate in Manchester as well. And the number of people who contacted me from Manchester to say, what a great guy, you know, what a sad thing that he's passed away at such a young age. But, you know, there's not many Scousers can go to Manchester and make the sort of difference that Paul did.
Yeah.
And, you know, we used to laugh and joke to me and say, you know, all the people he worked with in Manchester, he systematically dragged up to Liverpool and 9 times out of 10 got them to invest here. You know, so he was like guerrilla warfare as far as Paul was concerned, because he was very passionate about our city and, as Michelle rightly said, made a difference and leaves a fabulous legacy behind. And as I say, I'm sure the cathedral will do him proud on the 1st of February. Simon, I know you'd sort of heard of him because of his work through the Spirit of Shankly.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry to say I didn't know Paul from a business sense, but I was very much aware of him and his involvement with Spirit of Shankly. And the one thing I would say is it's not that regularly you come across someone who's reached the top of the game in terms of what business they're involved in, but really retains the human touch. And in my very limited knowledge compared to you guys of Paul, that's definitely the balance, I think, that was well struck. I think you often find that with true leaders, that they manage to achieve success, but they don't actually forget what characteristics got them there. Mm. And the people I respect most in leadership positions do that. And from what I knew of Paul, he had a great deal of my respect, absolutely.
Yeah, it was just a quote that I've seen lots of quotes this week from various people. But David Guest, who's the chairman of the Commercial District Partnership, summed it up really well for me. He said, there are no words that can do justice to such an inspirational character. Both professionally and personally, I had the utmost respect and affection for a much-loved man who was genuinely committed to Liverpool and whose achievements for the city will leave a lasting legacy. And I think that says it all, you know, sums it up in a few words. And Paul, if you are looking down upon us, you're probably laughing at me on Wednesday night when Liverpool knocked City out of the cup and got to Wembley. But I did raise a glass in your memory, and it was perhaps a fitting tribute from Liverpool Football Club on the night for you as well, mate. Well, that's it from me, Frank McKenna, and City Talks Business for another Sunday. Thanks to my guests, thanks to my producer, Jonathan Dean, and most of all, thank you for listening. Have a great week, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. Listen and log on to great music and great conversation on City Talk 105.9.